You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Time to have a bit of fun with our monthly share shootout and highlight a few counters worth adding to your portfolio with all the usual caveats that a few stocks or ETFs does not a diversified portfolio make. And there are a few interesting themes in the market at the moment. With vaccines being rolled out across the globe, sentiment has been boosted by expectations that things are going to get better and economies are going to recover, driving consumption and company earnings, as it looks like the policy response of offloading bazookas of new money has paid off for now. On the other side of that coin, market participants are starting to ponder on the real cost of all of this fiscal stimulus and this response, aided by monetary policy keeping rates at record lows. And with inflation starting to rear its head again, just how long can rates in the US, which are the benchmark for all asset prices around the world, stay at these record lows? Well, tech perhaps not as defensive as has been the case of late, and I think asset allocators are starting to worry about higher discount rates for long duration earnings stories. And when rates are zero, there's no opportunity cost to having a punt on something that may make a profit at some point down the line. Now, perhaps not so much. Let's welcome our share shooters, Carolyn Crimmin, Portfolio Manager at AdviceWorks, Ness & Nair, Sasfin Securities Portfolio Manager, and Henry Biddlecombe, Portfolio Manager at Anchor Capital. Carolyn, you're the first to fire for us, and you've gone with Cashbuild, the home improvement DIY story, a big theme during lockdown. Remind us where Cashbuild's strengths lie.
Well, Cashbuild is obviously a building and home improvement supplier here in South Africa. What is interesting about this company, it really serves the underserved market. So it has about 300 stores, but a third of those stores are in rural areas and a third of them in townships. And as the population grows and there's a little bit more disposable income, this is something that people are really spending a lot of money on to improve the homes they've got, you know, to add to the homes, you know, for more family members as more family members move in. So I've never been a fan of South African stocks. It's very rare that I actually, you know, put a South African stock forward. They really didn't have a good year. You know, the lockdown, the hard lockdown really does work for them, didn't work for a lot of cash from the balance sheet. And what is also nice about this company, it to a certain extent, even though it's a small company, it's the third of the size of Italtel, for example, It is a very regular dividend payer. It really is one of our dividend aristocrats. It pays between 2.5% and 3%.
And we saw back in September last year, Value Capital Partners taking a surprising, 5.2% stake. There was a flurry of activity and rumors circulating. Any further word on potential takeovers of Cashbuild?
You know, I really hope not. You know, I like the space they're in. I think they're very responsive to the South African consumer needs. And it's, like I said, it's a consumer that people really don't focus on. You know, you focus on the middle to high net worth consumers. They know their customers. They're where their customers are. You know, to get these big speculative guys in place, I'm never fond of this with this type of company. It is good that it is organic. It is South African, and it is in a growth area for South Africa.
Yeah, one wonders whether or not there might be a delisting in the future. It's certainly been a trend with small cap stocks, and you hope not if you're holding it for the long term. Nesson, first up, you've gone to MTN. I think it's one of the most talked about telco stocks in South Africa at the moment. It should be getting a real boost from Nigeria, one of its largest markets, if not its largest market because of the oil price. Yet, we just haven't seen the market quite re-rate this stock just yet. Why?
Yeah, good point, Michael. And I ask myself the same question. Why? And to understand why, I think you need to go back maybe 5 or 6 years. Remember that this was a very well-loved stock, a very well-followed stock. It used to be consistently, you know, the top five traded stock on the exchange every day. And I think in the last 5 years, it's lost a little bit of its mojo, particularly ever since that Nigeria, that first fine in Nigeria came along, you know, which was, I think, initially at $5 billion. Dollars and it ended up being settled at much less than that. The point is that a lot of investors have lost faith in the company. There were issues around corporate governance, and I think the minute you start losing your way as a big listed entity, a multinational, when it comes to things like that, I think investors you know, become very apathetic towards investing in you. But lots has changed in that company in the last sort of 2 years, ever since two, 3 years, ever since the new management has taken over. They've focused on their mainstream businesses. They've seen through probably the toughest slump in the oil price and now enjoying some sort of recovery from that. They're selling assets. They're raising cash. A lot of people are talking about this new spectrum that's going to be released in South Africa. And, of course, we've been talking about it for 10 years. No. But I think the fact that we've got now an urgent need with working from home, big demand coming from the private sector, it's probably a theme that's likely to continue post-pandemic. I think the need to release some of that radio spectrum is going to be there, which is going to represent the next growth driver for a lot of these telco companies. And, you know, MTN being one very well positioned for it. So I think there's lots of things that are happening in its favor, but I also think that the market may be a little bit apprehensive, about dipping in. From my perspective, I think it's probably worth the risk reward given the share price now in the low 70s.
And many in the market expecting it to go up to 100. It's also more than just a kind of dumb pipe utility type telco play. It's investing heavily and has invested heavily under Rob Shooter in fintech, in the next growth driver. So you're not just talking about a utility stock. What is the big risk, though, within that analysis? Is it further delays? Is it the political and sovereign risk around auction spectrum? What do you see as a potential risk?
I think the biggest risk for me with MTN is always going to be that Nigerian business and surprise fines or sort of sanctions coming out of Nigerian authorities. It's something that I think does weigh particularly heavily on the stock, given the exposure in Nigeria. They're also in Iran, which is another sort of volatile jurisdiction. Let's just say that, but I think the risks come from there, but I think from a pure investment perspective, the fact that it's so cash flow generative, the latest set of results came out, 10 Rand earnings. To me, there's always, from an investor's perspective, there's always more risk priced into these stocks than is actually justified.
10 Rand earnings at 70, at a PE of 7. I mean, there's a significant margin of safety there.
But not without risk.
But not without risk.
I think that's the...
Absolutely. Henry, your first choice, Intel, amongst the top three in the semiconductor chip space. It perhaps has lost ground to the other big two, Taiwan Semiconductor and NVIDIA. So why are you taking Intel out of the big three? Well, what do you like about the Intel story at the moment?
Yeah, I think the Intel story right now isn't unique in the tech space. It's a big incumbent that at one stage was very relevant. And it's kind of lost its relevance along the way. And like so many big incumbent tech companies, it got caught with its pants down in the broader shift to mobile and data center computing, which happened in the beginning gradually, but then all of a sudden. So they lost their way a little bit. They've got a big market share in the traditional verticals like desktop computing and server computing, but they don't have chips and mobile devices. They're losing ground in the laptop space, and they've lost out completely on the GPU market, which companies like NVIDIA and AMD lapped up. So it hasn't been a good story over the last 5 years. But of course, sentiment towards the company has understandably been quite poor as well. So the stock was actually trading at around 10 times earnings in December, and that's when you started to see some activist shareholder involvement start to appear, as it so typically does in instances like this. So you've got guys like Dan Loeb, Seth Klarman getting involved. Yeah. And they've been agitating for change at a board level, and you've now seen the now previous CEO, Bob Swan, stand down, and a new guy named Pat Gelsinger has stepped up to bat, and he comes from VMware. So there are a lot of positive catalysts for change there at the moment, and I still think that this is a company that demonstrates a lot of cutting-edge engineering ability. They've just lost a little bit of strategic direction. So getting into the fundamentals, I think the share is quite cheap at the moment. In my view, it's trading at around 10 times 2023 earnings, so there's limited downside risk. And I think if they start to make the necessary changes at a strategic level, the market will start to give the new leadership team the benefit of the doubt. And you could quite easily see a re-rating from 10 to, say, 15 times earnings, and that could give you a 50% return. So I think there's very limited risk here. with some pretty outsized upside, and that for me makes it an attractive investment.
What's not to like about that narrative? And the fact is, they, I mean, if you differentiate them between their competitors, they do a lot of the fabrication and manufacturing and design in-house, where Taiwan, for example, send that off to a foundry. So I like that part of the story as well. Carolyn, your second stock got a recent meme boost from Elon Musk. And as we know, that fundamentals don't matter anymore. It's all about your proximity to Elon. What's not to like about Shopify?
Yeah, well, the main thing I like about Shopify is that it was founded by two snowboarders. Okay, what's not to like? So really what it does, if people don't understand what it does, if you're a small or medium entrepreneur and you want to sell your products on the internet, you don't necessarily have the money or the skill to develop that infrastructure which allows you to communicate with your Visas, your MasterCards, and PayPal. And this is where Shopify steps in, that you contract with Shopify. Their subscription rates go from $29 to $2,000, and they really process all of that nasty admin business that maybe if you're a little leather producer or you're producing fudge or something online, you don't want to get involved in. It's a growth industry. I know they had tailwinds, the whole of 2020. It was really the environment. I know that their growth is going to slow, but it's relative. They grew their revenue by 87% this year. They grew their profitability by 78%. This is a growth industry, especially for the smaller retailers. They lag Amazon, obviously in the e-commerce space, but Amazon is not everything, and some smaller retailers will never want to be on Amazon for obvious reasons. They have 1.7 million people, well, should I say entrepreneurs, people who are actually using their platform. And it's actually now starting to expand to some of the bigger businesses, businesses like Yamaha or indeed Dermalogica.
Canadian-based. So we know the Canadians are good at their admin, and so Shopify certainly ticks those boxes. Nesson, your second pick is one of the comeback stories, I think, of all time in tech. If you look at what Microsoft has achieved from the early 2000s, it seemed it had just become another utility-type tech company. Satya Nadella came in, really breathed fresh life into the business, and you look at cloud now, a big runway. Why do you like Microsoft, say, over another big cloud player like an Amazon and Amazon Web Services? What is it about Microsoft that really appeals to you?
Yeah, Michael, I think you highlighted a few important points there, but to answer your question first, I think it's their subscriber base. I mean, Microsoft has got the biggest market in personal computing, in corporate computing. Everybody uses Microsoft Teams. A lot of people use other platforms as well. But, on the meetings that I attend, for example, as a sort of small sample, at least 60% of my meetings take place via Microsoft Teams. And the fact that, all Microsoft Office products and the operating system, is all integrated into one sort of convenient software as a service, if you can call it that, using the cloud, I think it makes it very convenient, very cost effective. You did mention Satya Nadella. Steve Ballmer was the guy that was in between Bill Gates, the founder, of course, and Satya Nadella. But Steve Ballmer wasn't a great visionary. He was he was Gates' friend, and I think he caretook Microsoft for a period of time when a lot of people were concerned that the federal government was going to break them up, because of antitrust reasons. Of course, that surfaced now as well amongst all the big tech shares, particularly in Europe. But, if you just take an example, it's very difficult to stop these big tech companies from growing the way they have, given the amount of subscribers they have, whether you talk about Facebook, Microsoft, Apple. I think the competition is going to come really from the Chinese, not really from antitrust legislation. And I think we're still many, many years away from that. I think the stage is set for Microsoft to grow into its cloud business in the next 5 years at least, and penetrate the corporate market even more than it has.
So we've given our portfolio managers a blank canvas to pick from anywhere in the world. We've had some local small caps, so we've gone offshore. And again, Henry, your second pick is offshore, but you've gone U.S. banks. The U.S. banking sector, interest rates at record lows over there. Are you betting that we might start seeing rates rise soon? The U.S. consumer, what do you like about big banks?
Yeah, it's difficult to say when they'll rise, but we know they will rise, right? So they've got that going. But I think last year was a tech story. You saw massive rotation into the tech names for reasons that we now understand. And one of the sectors that got left behind was U.S. financials. And that's because the factors that drive bank earnings turned in the wrong direction. Interest rates went downward. That squeezes net interest margins. And then, of course, you saw unemployment spike and people start to worry about loan book impairments. But all of that now, I think, is more than reflected in the share prices of banks. They're trading at really meaningful discounts to the justified price-to-book multiples that we calculate. And again, you know, it's always difficult to predict when and how inflation will return and when interest rates will rise. But we do know that basically, directionally, they've only got one way to go from here, and that's up. So at some point, these shares will become good opportunities again. And we think that you can achieve a very strong double-digit return if you buy a decent broad basket of U.S. financials now.
So how would you be accessing that? Would you be going for a US-based banking ETF? Would you be putting a basket together yourself?
How you can do that. So we've put it, in our funds, we put a basket together, which we can also offer to clients in segregated portfolios. You could also go along a US financials ETF, for example. But to name some names, I mean, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, US Bank Corp, or even on the riskier end of the spectrum, a Wells Fargo, are all good proxies for that theme.
Yeah, and riskier because we know some of the brand and reputation issues, particularly that Wells Fargo have suffered of late. Hopefully, put those behind them. Nesson, Carolyn, should we actually come back to you before we go back to you, Nesson? Carolyn, your last stock is ASML Holdings, NV Dutch company. You've picked it before, not a household name here in South Africa, but we all use it. ASML, what does it do?
Well, it is a chip lithography company. And if you don't know what that is, it is the company that builds the machinery that writes onto semiconductors. It has the biggest moat of any company that I've ever seen. It has 90% of the market share. It is an extremely tech-heavy company, but because the lead time for the equipment that it manufactures is so long, these are massive machines. It's less volatile than the semiconductor market. We're seeing right now that there is a shortage of semiconductor chips. You know, people cannot manufacture them fast enough, and they cannot get that equipment that manufactures them to them fast enough. And that's going to continue. You know, as tech grows, we're going to need more and more of these types of manufacturing machines. They're massive. I mean, they're about $100 million each, essentially. And this company, it's a little bit undervalued relative to the rest of the tech sector, but it is a slow and steady plodder. By that, I mean that you know that their net income was up 37%. they have, you know, they've got billions on the balance sheet. They pay dividends, unlike a lot of companies. They have share buybacks, and the technology that they have is really unimpeachable. Nobody, even the Chinese or the Taiwanese, have the tech that rivals ASML.
And as you say, that is a pretty wide and deep moat, as Warren Buffett would like to say. Are there any risks to that outlook, considering what you've just painted?
Well, look, I think one of the risks one could have said were trade wars, you know, between Europe and China. But I mean, I think the trade wars between the US and China are going to just take, you know, take a lot of the sting off that. I think the biggest risk is that we see a turnaround in tech, or possibly somebody steals their technology. You know, it's going to be a very different. I don't think we're going to see a turnaround in tech anytime soon. I think we probably all agree on this. Technology is going to become more and more important in your life. So I must be honest with you, I struggle very much to actually find something negative that could happen to this company, apart possibly from the theft of some of their proprietary technology.
ASML. I know some people from Generation Z are into the ASMR, which is completely different. No. It's about audio.
It's not audio
addictions or something. Nesson, your concluding pick is Visa. And we see shares of Visa were actually down quite a bit in the first month of this year. I think they were down around 11%. and it's either MasterCard or Visa in this space. Why Visa? And what do you like about this, considering that there are so many other fintechy-type payment companies around the world all trying to surely take a bit of Visa and MasterCard's lunch?
Yeah, but not being very successful at it. A lot of them have found that if you can't beat your competition, you might as well join them. So the back end, a payment platform for a lot of these fintech companies actually is either through Visa, MasterCard, or PayPal, which is, I think, a little bit more expensive and a little bit more niche. So, you know, for me, Visa is the biggest sort of, you know, secure payments provider that everybody trusts. And I think that word trust comes in because when it comes to putting, you know, personal details of yours, your credit card details, you know, on a public platform like an internet, you can be rest assured that people want to be able to trust that there will be a secure payment that goes through, you know, without necessarily them exposing themselves to sort of cyber attacks and things. I think Visa card and MasterCard do that very successfully. You know, they've been, as more and more consumption migrates digitally, we're seeing people, you know, a lot more people shopping now and entertaining themselves online, etc. I think the natural beneficiaries of that will be the likes of Visa and MasterCard. So it's one of those shares you're going to have for in your portfolio for a long time. You look at it over a much longer period. You know, they've done phenomenally well. They're going to have periods where, you know, results disappoint, things like any other company. And I think it's wiser to use those as buying opportunities to increase your exposure to them for the long term.
And would you see that as one of those opportunities right now from a relative valuation perspective?
Absolutely. I think if you are putting together a long-term, I don't want to say an overseas portfolio, because I think, you know, all share portfolios now should have mainly overseas and maybe a few local stocks. But if you think you're putting something together now for the long term for your kids or grandkids, you know, Visa would be one of the sort of building blocks of that portfolio. If you're going to have a portfolio of 20 or 30 stocks, one of the first ones you'd pick, in my view, is the likes of a Visa.
Yeah, and I'd be throwing one of the world's best venture capital firms, Tencent, into that mix as well. Don't go through NASPAS and process, go direct. Henry, talking about tech, your last pick is big tech. You've gone Facebook, Alphabet, Alibaba, and Amazon. Now, you said in the intro to the show that big tech was the big theme last year. There does seem to be something of a rotation away from tech. You're still quite bullish on tech. Why?
Yeah, Mike, so I think big tech, specifically the mega cap tech shares, are in an interesting place right now. I think particularly over the last 6 months, antitrust has birthed a lot of negative sentiment towards those stocks. You know, people hear antitrust, they think that there's going to be, you know, sort of shareholder value destruction, but we think it's the opposite. Often that can drive remedies like divestitures or spin-offs, which can actually create a lot of shareholder value. So I think those shares have got two things going for them at this point. One, they look quite fundamentally cheap. And two, you've got that that sort of breakup or divestiture optionality. They also reported an incredible set of results in the last quarter, whether you're looking at Facebook, Amazon, Alibaba, or Alphabet. You know, operationally, they're still demonstrating a lot of very strong momentum, and they've got some very powerful secular tailwinds blowing behind them. They have had for years. So I think it's a nice opportunity to pick those names up at a meaningful discount to their intrinsic value.
Yeah, rather than getting in at the top, it was interesting. I was watching Real Vision the other day, and Raoul Paul debating Bitcoin and all tech, and he said tech doesn't mean revert. He's always got a very short memory, because I've certainly seen tech mean revert, but I don't see that happening just yet. And on the antitrust side, I mean, who wouldn't want to be unlocking value in a company like Facebook if it's forced to divest of a WhatsApp or an Instagram? That is going to be a value unlock experience for shareholders. Well, there you have it. You can go and get your DIY at Cashbuild while importing some Canadian brands from Shopify on your Intel and ASML-powered Microsoft-enabled laptop using your MTN data, while you pay with your Visa credit card using your offshore US bank accounts, while Facebook and Alphabet watch your keystrokes. Carolyn Kremen, Portfolio Manager at AdviceWorks, Ness & Nair, or Sasfin Securities, and Henry Biddlecombe of Anchor Capital with your unlimited edition of Share Shootout.